Lake Effect continues on WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. A few weeks ago, we shared the story of a remarkable exhibit at Jewish Museum Milwaukee. The exhibit features a set of fabric collages created by Esther Nissenthal Krinitz, a woman who survived the Holocaust by fleeing her Polish village ahead of a Nazi invasion. Making the tapestry served both as a way to share her story with her daughters and as a way for her to work through the traumatic experiences of her childhood.
In essence, Krinitz had designed her own art therapy program. It has many similarities with how practitioners in the field help people. Later this month, the museum will host an event on the power of art therapy. We're joined by the museum's director, Patty Sherman Sisler, and two of the people on that panel, art therapist Emily Nolan and Jim Tassie, co-director of the Feast of Crispian, which pairs professional actors with post-deployment service veterans. Welcome to all of you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Mitch.
And Patty, I wanted to start with you. How do you see this work that you and your fellow panelists are talking about as connecting with what a museum, yours in particular, is all about?
The Jewish Museum Milwaukee's tagline is "Where conversations happen." And our current exhibit, which is The Fabric of Survival, The Art of Esther Nissenthal Krinitz, is the story of Esther, who lived in Poland pre-World War II, documenting her life pre, during, and post-World War II in fabric art. As we looked at the art and we talked about what Esther did as an artist, and we talked to her daughter, we really talked about how this was not only documenting her life, but it was cathartic for her. And it was a way for her to deal with her trauma, which led us to talk about what community resources are there out there for people in Milwaukee to deal with their traumatic experiences.
Well, and Emily Nolan, I wanted to ask you, because I had a chance to interview Esther's daughter about this exhibit, and I don't know whether you've seen the panels, but the thing that struck me was this seemed like it was art therapy that didn't necessarily start out consciously trying to be art therapy. And so I guess the question is, does there have to be a conscious decision for it to serve a therapeutic purpose?
I think that art making itself can be therapeutic. I think that there's some debate now as to whether or not there needs to be an art therapist present to make that more intentional, and I would tend to agree with that. But the basics of art making can certainly be therapeutic on their own.
And I wanted to ask both you and Jim about how the art and the mission sides of your personalities developed. How or when did the light bulb go off that connects these two parts of your brain, the part that is interested in making art and the part that is interested in helping people?
I made art from a very young age, and I enjoyed the way that it made me feel in my body. And when I was deciding what to do for a career, I wanted to be able to bring that to others, and I didn't quite know how to do that. It wasn't until I was actually an art teacher in a school outside of Chicago where there was a lot of gang violence that I had the opportunity to work with a group of young men who were stuck in a situation where they were fantastic artists. They used the art studio to hide because if they left the art studio, there was a chance that they would be recognized as a gang member, which they didn't want to be affiliated with. And so working with these boys helped me to understand that I needed more skills to be able to take that soothing aspect of art and be able to bring it really into the therapeutic realm.
You talked about how the doing art made you feel growing up.
Mm-hmm.
Did it surprise you that you realized you had this feeling in common with these young men that you know were at risk of being identified as part of a gang?
I think that it immediately resonated with me that if I felt it, of course other people could feel it too. It was just a matter of helping them or recognizing that they could tap into it.
Jim, talk about how these two parts of your own personality developed.
Sure. Here's what I think. I think it's possible for art to be a place where it's safe to be frightened. It's safe to be afraid. There's a way of doing that, of really being the, of exploring that. In our work with veterans, the Feast of Crispian, we looked at veterans in various phases of reintegration, addiction issues, and one of the points that became very clear in that constellation of events was a shutdown of emotions. So from an actor's viewpoint, that's something that you use. You are the instrument of your own observation and expression, and you use yourself. You use your own stuff. So for the veterans, we thought, our idea was, well, what if we play? What if we pretend and hide behind the mask of the character and still allow those emotions to come up? And that's what's happening for us. We're starting to find that. And then the last thing I would add in terms of art is that what we're finding is that when you shut down one emotion, you shut down a bunch of them, and that pretty soon nothing, you have no feeling about anything. Man delights not me, says Hamlet. But that when you get a chance to taste it, even as Brutus, as somebody else, it's still your stuff. But you get a chance to explore it fully and put it into the language and have something to hang on to.
You talk about your realizations that these two worlds connect. Do the people that you're working with have to come to the conscious realization that these worlds are connecting, or does the therapy just happen?
I just left working with a client, and we were working with intention, and we were trying to really create a solid intention for the client to be able to move into just what you were talking about, being able to, she can't feel joy if she doesn't feel pain, and feel those two things together. And so I think that there has to be an inkling of an awareness, but then we can work to bring that awareness into full intention.
Yeah, and I would respond, I don't think you need much. We tend to do our stuff and then talk about it later, have the experience. I believe as an artist that that we learn by experience,
yes,
as much as cognition. And so most of the time we say, jump in the water, figure out how not to drown, and we'll talk about it later. That's kind of the deal.
Let's embody it. Let's
exactly
try it
so.
Out.
Right, exactly
yeah, we
so.
Can sort it out later, but
right.
Bring it into your body, yep. And let's see what happens.
I quite agree. Let's do it. We'll decide what to call it later.
Yeah.
Is there an opening for people to start that process just by seeing a static exhibit, if you will, in a place like a museum?
I definitely think so. We've experienced people returning again and again to this museum or to this exhibit. Some of the comments have been that it's been very profound, that they looked at the juxtaposition of the beautiful artwork with the horrendousness of the story and had a cathartic experience. We have also used and have programs associated with art making so that people can go down that road. And we also give them a place to write about their feelings in the exhibit, what they see, what they thought, and how it affected them.
Emily Nolan, I think people might have a general sense for how, you know, psychotherapy works, for example. But can you give us a peek into the world of how you work with a client? Because it's... I think kind of a mystery to people who have not been through art therapy, how you go from someone walking in your door who might be dealing with this or that and using this tool that maybe they don't even know they have.
Sure. Well, there's lots of different ways to work with people, and we work with individuals, we work with groups and communities as well. But I can give you a snippet of working with an individual. And for me, I really like to connect with the client. I mean, all of this only works if there's a trusting relationship that is in place with the client before any of this happens. So I make sure that I'm building with rapport with the client, but then the client comes in and we do a check-in as to how their week was and what's most relevant to where they are right now. And then because I'm creative, I come up with what I call an art task or an experiential for them to work on right there in the session with me. And so I will give them a limited choice of what materials to use. Those materials are based on what sort of control properties they have, and then the client will make the choice and address the issue for whatever visual way they want to do it and we've decided would be best. And then we take a few moments at the end, you know, to really process what the experience was like for them, what they feel in their body, what thoughts and feelings they're having in relationship to the artwork that they made.
Let me ask a really basic question. Does proficiency come into play?
No, it doesn't, because really what happens is that it's all about the process, and it's process-oriented, which can be a bit of a trick because it's countercultural. We're mostly product-oriented in our culture. And, of course, people come in and they are worried about how their artwork looks, and we say, you know, that's totally normal for you to want it to look good. But just so you know, I'm not judging your artistic ability, and it doesn't have to look good. It just has to do what it needs to do to get you to a place to be able to manage your emotions or whatever goal it is that we're working toward.
Jim, obviously things are a little bit different for you because people have to make the conscious decision to be there and be part of this specific output, if mm-hmm. you will. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, talk about the proficiency there and the leap people have to take to want to expose themselves in the way that what you do with them exposes themselves.
Yeah. As we mentioned earlier, I think we put them in a situation where they're doing the words very quickly. These are techniques that have been devised by a group from out in the East Coast called Shakespeare and Company. They're rehearsal techniques. So you simply stand beside the actors, the veterans, and you say the words in their ear and they say the words to their scene partner. So they're in the middle of this thing. And what happens is there's this really lovely, from my point of view, kind of character muting. I'm giving Brutus his lines, and before long, he doesn't know whether he's Brutus or himself, and he starts speaking from that point of identity. And what happens is all of a sudden, his own stuff starts coming up, and it's the wonderful, dense, metaphoric language of Shakespeare that pulls a lot of emotion out of people. And all of a sudden, things start coming up that they haven't been able to deal with. That in a more formalized of therapy, they can't put words to. That for which I can find words is already dead in my heart, Nietzsche said. And that's why I believe experience is so important.
To bring it all into the here and now.
It's there. It's in the present.
Right. Yep.
Yeah. The immediacy.
Right.
Yeah.
Is there a fundamental question about art you have to be able to work through in order to do this work? The question of who it's for? This art is, at its heart, not really about the audience.
Yeah, that was actually something that was difficult for me, being an artist as well. And before I became an art therapist, I went to art school and I became an art teacher and I was teaching techniques to people. And it was about the product and very product oriented. And the product scared me to death. And so for a really long time, I didn't put any marks on any pages because I was afraid of failure. And so the way that I worked through that is when I finally said, you know, I'm denying something if I stop creating because I'm afraid of the product. And so I slowly started to keep a visual journal, which to me was the gateway because I was able to close the visual journal and I didn't have to share it with anybody else, but I was still expressing it. So I did have to work through that for myself and say, you know what, I don't care. This is something that I need for me, and so I'm going to do it regardless of what it looks like.
Does art still make you feel the way it did when you were growing up and becoming an artist?
100%. 100% of the time.
Drawing on your story about, and forgive me, I don't remember her name, the woman.
Esther.
Esther, and her attempt to capture her memory in fabric. It seems pretty clear that she was doing it both for herself and for her children. For the vets, the stories that they hold, the stories that they have, many of which are horrific, and for which they have served for our needs. So at one level, it's about the personal pop. Okay, this is happening to me. What I like to tell the vets is, what we like to tell them is that possibly as a veteran, you have one last duty, and that's to make sure that your story gets out to us. So to answer your question, yes, there is both a personal and a relationship with a larger population in terms of that resonance, it seems to me.
Mm-hmm. Well, Patty and Jim and Emily, thank you all for sharing these stories with us, and best of luck to all of you in all your work.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Thanks, Mitch.
Emily Nolan is an art therapist and director of the Bloom Center for Art and Integrative Therapies. Jim Tassi is co-director of the Feast of Crispian, and Patty Sherman Sisler is director of Jewish Museum Milwaukee. There's a link to more information about the museum's exhibit and event series on art therapy at wuwm.com.